97.9 FM, WCHL, and the UNC College of Journalism and Mass Communication presents Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. Sports Focus is dedicated to in-depth examinations of issues of overarching importance in the sports world. Each week, we'll discuss problems and look for solutions to problems in professional, collegiate, and amateur sports. From Carroll Hall on the UNC campus, here's your host, journalism professor Charlie Tuggle.
Welcome to Sports Focus. Our topic today, the long-range effects of the removal of the Confederate battle flag from the South Carolina Capitol grounds, particularly as it relates to sports. Our guest, Earl Smith, author of Race, Sport, and the American Dream. He's Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Wake Forest University. Earl, I guess when we're talking about sports, the immediate effect is that the ban against the state of South Carolina hosting NC2A tournament games has now been lifted. Is that the big takeaway from a sports point of view?
Well, that's one of them, and it's sort of unfortunate.
What's unfortunate about it?
That you have to have something like the removal of the Confederate flag from a flagpole for amateur intercollegiate athletics to be able to hold contests, and especially postseason contests, in the state of South Carolina. I think it just tells you how horrible this whole thing has been.
So do you blame the NC2A for that, or who's to blame for that being the case?
Everybody. It's obviously a South Carolina issue. The NCAA is only going to go where they feel their constituents will go. And like the NFL, the football professional people, not holding the Super Bowl in states that didn't pass the Martin Luther King birthday celebration, et cetera. So the NCAA is only going to do what's important for the NCAA.
And now that the ban has been lifted on South Carolina, only Mississippi stands under that ban. It's a little different, it seems, for Mississippi because it's not a separate flag. That symbol is part of the state flag. Does that create another layer of issue here, do you think?
It absolutely does. And one of the things you can say about the university there, the one that had the rebel as the mascot, at least they went ahead. I don't know if it was because they were forced to do it or not, but at least they went ahead and made that change before the state has decided to make a change to remove the piece of the Confederate flag or Confederate flag symbol from the flag.
Earl, I wanted to ask you about, you know, some people have said, you know, it's fine that they removed the flag. You know, that's within South Carolina's purview to do that. But why should a group like the NC2A or the NFL impose its views on another group of people?
I don't think they are. I think they're just going with what happened. Sport is, look, here's the deal. Sport is a reflection of the society in which we live. And that's one of the first things we need to understand. They're simply saying, we got to put people in the seats. If we're going to have the NC2A first round or final round of basketball in South Carolina, we want to make sure people come there. That's why you have these contests, or at least that 50% of the deal. And if you're going to hold a contest and nobody comes, well, you got a problem. So they have to have a feel from the larger society as to what will work and what won't work. Look at it this way. You don't hold the Rose Bowl in North Dakota, you see?
Mm-hmm.
The reason why you don't hold it there is because nobody's going to go there to watch football in the dead of the winter in North Dakota. So all of those postseason bowl games are held in places where the sun shines. And so the NCAA is a pretty, whether you like the NCAA or not, it's a pretty sophisticated and very smart organization. They do things that support their interests.
And I have been on record on this program for a long time saying I'm not generally a big supporter of the NC2A, but in this case, I have no real problem with the NC2A having made that stand to say that, you know, at least some of our constituents, some of the people who we do want to attract to come to these games, won't come simply because that flag is flying above the Capitol. So you,
exactly.
You see that
exactly.
As, yeah.
And fans, you know, I'm glad to hear you say that, because generally, and once we get off the phone, I don't know what's going to happen or what's going to be said. But sports fans are some very interesting people. You know, a lot of people talk about fair weather fans, et cetera, and so forth. So if I'm hearing you correctly, if fans have said, we're not going to come to South Carolina or to Arizona or wherever because these states represent something that we're not interested in, I'm going to applaud that, because finally something good is happening, and something good is happening as it pertains to the NCAA. Generally, not a lot of good things take place under the rubric of the NCAA.
Well, on that point, we can certainly agree, and I think we agree about this larger point about the flag and what it represents to a large number of people, notwithstanding those who say it's part of their heritage, it's part of their history, but to a large number of people, it represents a time of oppression. So,
here's the flip side of that heritage coin.
Mm-hmm.
That flag is also a part of other people's heritage and history, which may not be as positive as some people would say their heritage and history is. Here's what we have in the United States of America. We have museums for all kinds of issues related to heritage. If you go to Greenville, where the Cotton Museum is, Greenville, Mississippi. I took a class to Greenville, Mississippi to study social stratification a couple of years ago, several times, several different classes. And one of the places we visited was the freaking Cotton Museum. And the students are saying, what are we doing going to the Cotton Museum? They say, well, it's a part of the history of the state of Mississippi. The people who once lived there and worked there picked cotton for which they were not paid. And we generally call those people slaves. And so in this museum, you see something about that history. That's the right place to have that kind of conversation, not on a flagpole or the dome of a state capitol.
Sports Focus, we'll be right back. Welcome back to Sports Focus. We're talking with Earl Smith, who is the author of Race, Sport, and the American Dream, about the overarching and long-term effects of the Confederate battle flag coming down from the state capitol in South Carolina. Earl, what does this particular change in South Carolina say about society in general, and how that does, what role that plays in your book? You know, you talk about the industrial sports complex and how that works, especially for athletes of color.
Well, it says that change comes slowly. That's the first thing it says. I would hope that this symbolic move, because that's how I see it, because it hasn't changed the socioeconomic or political structure in South Carolina one iota. This symbolic move says that there are people, regardless of why they chose to make the change, there are people there who decided in 2015 that it's time to make the change.
Earl, I didn't have a chance to read your entire book between the time that we managed to get you as a guest on the show and now, but am I to take it from your book that the American Dream is largely based in athletics, or has been at least for many, many young African-American males particularly?
No, absolutely not. You have, and the numbers are in the book, but, you know, you have less than 2,000 African-American athletes who can pay the rent, pay the mortgage, buy the kids' shoes through sport. Did you hear me correctly?
Yes.
2000. So that right there tells you that can't be the route to access the American dream. There has to be some other way, and that other way is embedded within the society in which we live. For those men and women who do access the dream through sports, that's great, and you know, more power to them. But there are far too many people who chase that sports dream that never get there.
I guess what the question should have been is there the perception among many young African-American athletes that this is the only way? And is there, how do we express to those young men particularly that there is another way? It doesn't have to be, sports doesn't have to be the only lifeline out of, you know, whatever sort of lifestyle you find yourself in.
You're absolutely correct. The perception is large. The perception is huge. The perception is taught by a lot of not very well-meaning people that this is what you should do, Johnny, and this is what you should do, Jake. And in the meantime, as long as you have muscles, as long as you can jump, as long as you can shoot, as long as you can play some kind of a game, that you should pursue this. And all the while, other avenues of access to this dream are being cordoned off, and that full access is not available. And if full access was available, you wouldn't see all these kinds of initiatives that come out of the White House that are somewhat meaningless in and of themselves, but you wouldn't see that kind of push if there was full open access for everybody.
Then the question for me, Earl, is, and here I think we'll broaden it out to all athletes, or let's say the great majority of athletes, they tend to see themselves first as athletes. And is that society's fault, or is it that their fault, or whose fault is that?
It's everybody's fault. If you know, as parents, as academicians, et cetera, we teach young people what those pathways are to adulthood, to adolescence, to success. And if we're teaching them that for this summer, what you need to do, Johnny, is get up and pick up that basketball and pick up that football and get ready to go to camp. And at the same time, we said nothing about the other pieces of life that are important, like reading, going to the library, getting ready for fall semester. If we leave all those other pieces out, then Johnny or Jake or Mary or whoever it is, that's exactly what they're going to do. And here's what happens in my book. I talk about the fact of what happens to all these athletes when their athletic life is over. And usually it's over at what we non-athletic people would call an early age. You're out of athletics at 32, 34 years of age. Guess what? In the United States, with the life chances extending well into the 80s, et cetera, 80 years of age, you got the rest of your life in front of you. Now what are you going to do? What exactly are you going to do? And we know that, unfortunately, the people who did have the good fortune to become professional athletes and make money, too many of those people were given bad advice in terms of what to do with that money.
Sports Focus will return right after this. Welcome back to Sports Focus. We're talking with Earl Smith, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Wake Forest University, about a sport, the American dream, race, the Confederate battle flag, a fairly wide-ranging discussion. Earl, you mentioned that the lucky ones who get a pro career and manage to play until they're 32 or 34 still have 50-something years of life after that. What about the ones who, and you know, you can try to tell a young person this, but Young people tend to think of themselves as invincible. It's not, you know, you're lucky if you get to 32 or 34, your career as an athlete could be over in an instant, not just at an early age, in an instant, based on an injury that ends that career. How do we share that reality with kids who think they're invincible?
It's a very complex issue, and I'm sorry we don't have much more time to talk about it. It's complex in these ways. If you have a young male or a young female who has talent, which you know has a very short shelf life, if they have talent, you want them to pursue it. And as an academician, you know, I shudder when I hear from students saying, my parents don't want me to go into music, or they don't really want me to go into art because I won't be able to make a living there. Well, guess what? There's a lot of people who go into business who can't make a living. So you want people to explore what they want to do in their lives. But what you try to say in terms of advice for young people is to, you know, go after your dream, explore where your talents are going to take you, but realize that you have to always have Plan B available to you. Plan B might be going to college. Plan B might be taking up a trade, but something else that you can latch on to if your first pathway doesn't work for you. And for athletes who do make it, they also need to know that those other 50 years, there's not a lot of jobs. You're I think, in the journalism media area. There's not a lot of jobs on ESPN. There's only so many slots there. So there has to be other ways to make a living besides broadcasting. So you want people to be able to have a couple of fallback programs that they can rely on that's going to sustain them for the rest of their lives.
Earl, this I think is one of the big problems with the sports complex as we see it, is that these star athletes are brought in and they're built up with, oh gosh, you're going to go to the league and you're going to have a great career, and oh yeah, there happen to be some classes at this really good university, and you know, sure, you need to go to class. We don't really push them to take advantage of those other opportunities that they have as college athletes, because there's no time left with all the time that they put into their athletic pursuits.
And that's what's wrong with that strange term, student athlete. Once you get to that rarefied place in Division I or Cadillac Division of intercollegiate sports, we need to cut the charade. Tennis, baseball, soccer, football, basketball, they're all semi-pro programs. And to be able to compete in semi-pro programs, you have to be the best. And reading, you know, fooling around with some eighth grade arithmetic, all those kinds of things are only a part of the deal that the NCAA cut with higher ed institutions. And one of the things I talk about in my book is it's still just absolutely blows me away that the NCAA essentially controls higher education. It doesn't make sense. There is no sense to why that particular organization can start telling you how many credits you need, what the score you need, et cetera. They have nothing to do with higher education at all, not one thing. And I've asked every professional out there, sports sociologists, economists, everybody who claims to be in this business of studying sport, what is the relationship of the NCAA? Why does it even exist? And over 25 years, I haven't heard an answer. Schools should be running their own programs. If Michigan wants to do it one way, let them. If Chapel Hill wants to do it another way, let them. as long as there's an agreed upon set of rules that would govern how that whatever it is works. Not someplace in Indianapolis that has no connection to the higher ed institution, wherever it might be.
And that does it for this edition of Sports Focus. Thanks to our guest, Earl Smith. Thanks also to engineer Dylan Field. And as always, thanks to you for listening. Cheers.
Thanks to Richard Southall, Mark Nagel, and Deborah Southall of the College Sport Research Institute at the University of South Carolina for their research and guidance, and for access to CSRI's international network of sources. Sports Focus is a production of UNC's College of Journalism and Mass Communication.